As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Ooh, Halloween special on a haunting afternoon for Ten Hag. Today, we'll be talking Manchester Derby, also Chelsea handing big treats to their visitors and too much toffees for West Ham. Also today, Wolves Newcastle, the net for Huang and the Neto Twang. Nketiah is on fire and football in the Faroes. It's the Totally Football Show. Sunday 29th of October. Hello, listener. It's probably Monday with you, eh? But here's what we got for you today. Some Tim Spears.
Hi, James.
Hello, Tim. A little bit of Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello, Jimbo.
Hello there, Seb. Thank you for dropping in.
I'm very excited to be here.
Well, that's great news. Not here, but equally excited are Daniel Story. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, James.
And Adrian Clark.
Hello, everybody.
Nice. Daniel's story this week was a one-man population surge, weren't you, Daniel?
Yeah, I added about 0.02% of the population of the Faroes. Yeah.
Right. Well, you went to Klaksvík. Is that Klaksvík?
Klaksvík. Kaoi, as they pronounce it. It's just, right. They say, Kaoi.
Kaoi, okay. Which has a population of 5,094 people, but still managed to have the first ever victory in a European competition by a Faroe Islands team, and you were there to watch it on Thursday.
Yeah, I've been planning this piece ever since the draw was made, because they're the first Faroese team to even reach the group stage. And as Kaoi did, I circled this fixture at home to Olympia Ljubljana as, okay, this is one that they're probably going to perform the best in, aka not lose. And then they went and drew at home to Lille, which was a phenomenal result, and slightly put the pressure on their performance on Thursday night, both for me and them. But they were fantastic. They won 3-0. They're only 2 points off qualification place at the moment in the Conference League. And I mean, it's a remarkable story. They are a semi-professional team. The first goal was scored by an electrician, the third by a fish farm worker. I think there's a tendency with these sort of minnow clubs to think, well, someone's probably shoved a load of money in, or they're probably run by this huge corporation. That's not true. They are just a tiny little town in the Faroes, and they can't quite believe it just as much as I couldn't quite believe it.
Magnificent. You also went to West Ham this weekend. Which journey took longer?
Well, I sat down for longer in the Faroes journey. I was stood up all the way home from London, as is traditional. And yeah, I saw a far worse home performance from West Ham than I did from Kaoi, because, yeah, I mean...
All right.
They were so, we'll touch on it later, yeah, they were so insipid.
More on that and Daniel away with the Faroes later on in the show. Quick check on the Premier League results this weekend. Everton won on Sunday 1-0 at West Ham. Liverpool beat Forest 3-0. Villa were 3-1 winners against Luton. Brighton drew 1-1 with Fulham. The Seagulls have still never beaten the Cottagers in the Premier League. And in the Manchester derby, Man City beat Man United 3-0. That leaves City still 1 point ahead of Liverpool, still level with Arsenal, who battered Sheffield United 5-0 on Saturday, and still 2 points behind Spurs, who on Friday beat Crystal Palace 2-1. Also this weekend, Brentford got their usual win at Chelsea. They've now won, in fact, more league games at Stamford Bridge in the last 7 months than Chelsea have. At Wolves and Newcastle, Newcastle drew 2-2. Bournemouth-Burnley turned out to be not boring in the slightest. The Cherries getting their first win, in fact, of the season against their bottom three rivals, 2-1. The Cherries thus moving out of the bottom three. Luton dropping back into it again. Burnley stay 19th and Sheffield United are in last place, 5 points from safety. All right, to Old Trafford for some red-hot derby action.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Rodri clouted it, Onana reacted, Haaland's onto it, and Foden steers it home. Manchester City gloriously greedy.
Yep, Phil Foden wrapping it up there for Man City on Sunday afternoon in their 3-0 derby victory over the neighbours. The first two goals coming from Erling Haaland, who Duncan Alexander points out has now scored as many Premier League goals as Swindon Town. Although, to be fair, Swindon Town did it three games quicker than Erling Haaland did. So, yeah. Anyway, thoughts on the derby? Well, first of all, Seb, you're joining us exclusively to talk about this game, so drop it on us.
Well, I mean, this is a compliment, but it was quite sterile. It was not red hot. Sorry to ruin your intro, but it felt very, very controlled from City. I think previously with this game, we've seen Manchester United, depending on what state they're in, regardless of it, being able to kind of play above themselves and unsettle Manchester City's rhythm and interfere with their mechanics. And this was as slick a City performance as I can remember seeing it at Old Trafford. It was so dominant. It looked so easy at times. And yeah, a couple of really nice saves from Edison, especially in the first half right at the end. But everything worked exactly as it should do for City. And I think if I'm a Man United fan, I think the very least I expect is some interruption, some chaos, a little bit of turmoil to kind of inflict upon Guardiola's master plan for the game. And you didn't get any of that. And in a derby, that's so disappointing.
City with an XG of almost 4.
Really?
Even more than Newcastle had when they put 8 goals past Sheffield United. Adrian, though, were City helped a little bit, though, with the awarding of that penalty, which kind of got things rolling?
Of course they were. They were given a leg up. I don't think I would dispute that it was a foul at all. I think it was a foul, but that kind of incident happens, I don't know how often, 30, 40 times every weekend. And VAR doesn't search it out with the same enthusiasm as it seemed to here. So it happened. It was the breakthrough goal, but look, Manchester City were vastly superior, as the stats would outline. This was men against boys. I thought the performance was an awful reflection on Erik ten Hag. Seb just touched on it there. Basically, what Seb was saying was that they didn't play with any fire in their bellies. They didn't lay a glove on Manchester City. I think the midfield, in particular, were chasing shadows throughout the game. You could look at the starting lineup and say, well, why didn't Varane play ahead of probably Evans? Why did Reguilón not play instead of Lindelof out of position at right back? And then you can ask the question, why did he take Amrabat off and put on Mount and effectively weaken the central midfield defensively for that second half? So I think, and then you get to the behaviour of the players, Bruno Fernandes, Anthony, really petulant in the second half, almost looking to get themselves sent off. That's what it felt like watching it. So I think that dressing room is rotten. I think it's been bad for a long, long, long time. And unfortunately, I think Erik ten Hag has lost that dressing room. And I think he's a little bit lost for ideas to fix it. So this was a really bad day for him. And I think he's under quite a lot of pressure now.
Seventh of eight in 14 games. Yeah, among the many people posing questions indeed about the starting lineup, Colin Miller, who said a thesis could be written on how Man United are a broken, dysfunctional mess, but a manager spending a large chunk of a limited transfer budget to sign a midfielder, Mount, who he doesn't start, and a striker, Hoyland, who he takes off when chasing a goal with no alternative, is extraordinarily damning, Colin continues. Then you have Anthony, United's second most expensive player, at the manager's behest and without any pushback from senior club figures, also not trusted to play, his sole contribution limited to avoiding a deserved red card. Incredibly damning for everyone involved. Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. When they appointed Ten Hag, we were told, or we were led to believe, it was because he was this kind of breath of fresh air tactically, but also that he was going to kind of bring this meritocracy to the club, that the Ronaldo situation being the obvious example, that Manchester United had too many bad eggs in the squad. And I don't mean bad eggs as in, you know, disruptive personally, but that there was not enough built for the future. There's not enough future proofing for this squad. So his idea that he would come in, there would be this meritocracy, no one would have their place, and it would be all pure performance based. And the reality is that he has either walked away from that or been forced away from that by the performance of certain players and by his own underperformance. We are 18 months into his job now, and the one thing we expected in month one from Ten Hag is that we could look at Manchester United and think, this is a Ten Hag team, this is a Manchester United team that he wants to bring. It might not always work, they might not always win, but there would be a system. The obvious example is with De Zerbi. Brighton are on a poor run at the moment, they haven't won in 5 or 6, but you can still tell what they're trying to do, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Manchester United have this incredibly expensive squad, and yet it's basically hard to work out what the plan is most of the time. That's very hard to do against Manchester City anyway when they're playing well. But in those circumstances, you at least expect this kind of derby mentality to take over. And the only time they started putting a foot in, really, was when the game was lost. And it was to try and foul players, not to try and win the ball. It was complete indiscipline. And when you combine a lack of obvious tactical philosophy, results moving in the wrong direction, and very obvious indiscipline within the squad, yeah, I agree with Adrian. It looks like he's lost that. And we know there are certain players in that squad who are banking that they will last longer than he will, Jadon Sancho being a very obvious example. And I wonder if there's another 2 or 3 that are thinking, I'm quite happy that Jadon's taking this heat because I'm silently behind him.
It never really feels like adversity informs anything at Manchester United. So when you see every fan can relate to this. So you watch your team play, especially when they're under, you know, in the first sort of year, 18 months of a managerial cycle. And you think, well, I can tolerate seeing that go wrong and that go wrong and that go wrong because it's going to inform the thinking going forward. As Manchester United, you never get the sense that when an experiment goes wrong or a player doesn't perform quite so well against a particular opponent or in a certain situation, nothing changes as a result of that. And I think that would be my biggest frustration with Erik ten Hag is that there's no evolution's probably the word that I'm looking for. Like you have your spending and you have your pieces being put around, and I think the guys are probably right about the dressing room culture and the pliability of some of these players, but the way forward isn't very clear. It's not tactics by a process of elimination. You're not really discovering anything with these performances. And I think you hate losing to your local rivals, but you don't think, well, in a week, we've learned X, Y, and Z, and therefore we're going to be a little bit better as a result of that. And it's difficult to take and difficult to watch, actually.
Daniel mentioned about attacking identity, but there wasn't even a defensive plan that I could see. When you've got...
Especially, let's talk about that second City goal then.
Yeah, absolutely. When Haaland is drifting away from four players who are running in the opposite direction to go towards the ball, and he's just left, you know, the most prolific striker in the world, is left with a free header. He had so much space. It was absolutely pathetic, to be honest. You know, I look at what Wolves did against City a few weeks ago. They completely stopped Haaland with Craig Dawson. You know, it's not okay. You need to completely sacrifice some attacking ambitions to do that, and it's a little bit shameless, which of course Wolves can do. Maybe United can't at Old Trafford, but there was no plan at either end of the pitch, and it sort of reminded me of like an FA Cup tie between like a minnow. And a big club in that United were purely looking at like moments of individual brilliance, mostly from like direct attacks, and like they probably needed a bit of momentum and the crowd to get involved and win them the game. You know, you look at City, such a well-oiled machine, and United are just like a bit of like a cut and shut, really, with Evans and Maguire at centre-back and Lindelof at full-back. They remind me of where sort of Spurs were a year ago, that everyone's just quite miserable. And they're relying on sort of late moments of brilliance, just like Spurs were, late comebacks or something special from Harry Kane or an individual player to get through games. But in terms of performances, even when United have been winning the last few weeks, performances have not been good. In terms of dominating games, in terms of just fun and just enjoying it, it's not there at all. And you can only see changes having to happen on the horizon because they're only going in one direction.
Mm. Newcastle United coming up in the League Cup midweek. Be interesting to see what happens with that. As for City, meanwhile, they can make you look bad. But what did you most enjoy about their performance?
I thought the left-hand side were brilliant. I really did. I thought that Bernardo and Jack Grealish were just a wonderful double act. Down that side, you saw it for the two big chances for Erling Haaland, with Bernardo going around Grealish, getting to the byline and digging out those crosses to the far stick. Bernardo was superb. But Grealish put in a top performance, maybe his best of the season. And Jeremy Doku probably deserves some credit for that because he's been sensational, hasn't he? The best dribbling winger in the Premier League across the last few weeks. And I think he laid down a marker that Jack responded to in this game. So yeah, well done to him. And obviously the Stones-Rodri axis being back in full swing again now is alarming for the rest of the division because those two are just so slick. Nothing gets through them and the ball just manoeuvres serenely around the pitch when those two are at the base of that engine room. So yeah, this was an outstanding Manchester City performance. I thought they'd make Manchester United look bad and they did.
Again, we've completely taken him for granted, as we always do with Rodri, because again, he's the one that controls the tempo somehow with and without the ball. I think he's the best midfielder at the world in dictating the tempo of his team's play when they have the ball. And that's managing the situation in the game as well. That's not necessarily playing at the same speed all the time. It's dictating which speed to play at. But without the ball, he's just phenomenal because he's not quick. He's not hugely physical. His reading of the game is magnificent. He is kind of Guardiola's ultimate disciple. And, you know, my God, they've missed him when he's not been there this season. But he doesn't get injured often and he doesn't miss many games. And if he doesn't miss any between now and the end of the season, they'll win the league with ease.
Was it Rodri who was hauled back by Hoyland for the penalty, which, you know, just to mention, that was, did you know, the first penalty that Manchester City have ever been awarded at Old Trafford in the Premier League era. The last time they were given a spot kick there was April 1992. Keith Curl dispatched it in a 1-1 draw. Keith Curl.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we should say that they were rotten for about half of those years at Old Trafford. And then they were so good that they didn't need penalties for the other half. So, yeah.
Just a quick word on Erling Haaland. He's scored the same amount of goals as Manchester United this season.
That's 11. Nice. What a telling statistic, Adrian. Thank you so much. Seb, you're going to depart now on account of the fact that you haven't watched anything else this weekend, apart from Spurs, who are coming much later on. So many thanks for stopping by on your way to Hamburg, I think.
I'm going to Frankfurt and then Dortmund and then Hamburg.
All right.
Like a kind of sort of low-rent Jason Bourne kind of character. Just, you know, jet-setting lifestyle.
And you can follow Seb's progress and indeed all the magnificent articles that it furnishes on The Athletic. Thank you anyway for being with us. Catch you soon, Seb.
Thanks for having me, Jimbo.
Four other games played on Sunday, three of which were at 2 o'clock and not on TV. So I'm not sure how much you saw of Liverpool or Villa's wins or the Brighton-Fulham draw.
I caught quite a bit of Brighton. They're in a bit of a funk at the moment. And under Graham Potter, they had this, you know, we all know they were the XG champions. They created a huge number of chances and missed them. Under De Zerbi at the moment, it's slightly shifted further away from goal in that they've had more than 70% possession in three games this season, two in the league and one in the Europa League. And they've taken 1 point from those three games, which is today. And they're just struggling to break teams down who sit with that low block. They had 18 shots today and most of them were from range where I think they created a total XG of about 1.5 from 18 shots, which, you know, to cut through those numbers, they're basically taking the shots from too far away and from positions where they're unlikely to score. And that's become a bit of a theme this season, I think. I don't know what the answer is because they love playing on that counter, but we've said it before, Adrian said it before, every opposition manager in the Premier League now knows I'm going to sit behind the ball. If I can counter, I will. And if I can't, then I will just kind of shut up shop and try and concede one or no goals. And it is working against Brighton.
Yeah, in regards to the game, João Paulinho kind of was the story of the match. Should have been sent off.
Oh, really?
What, one of the most blatant deliberate elbows that I've seen for a long, long time on Pascal Gross. It was nasty. I'm not quite sure how he got away with it. But he's a brilliant player. He is the heartbeat of Fulham. Without João Paulinho, Fulham go down. Mm. I think there's no doubt about that.
They may only have about another 2 months with him, of course.
Well, this is true. This is true. If Bayern Munich come back in for him, he should go because I do think he belongs at that level. He made 10 tackles in the game, which is just extraordinary.
More than any player in a Premier League game this season.
Really? Yeah, I didn't know that. And on top of that, he picked up 11 ball recoveries. So that's winning possession without having to make a tackle. So he was outstanding. He scored a great goal from a turnover. Brighton have given a few of those away trying to play out from the back this season. So, yeah, a bit for Brighton to work on. And Fulham, really, it's all about Palhinha.
Okay. Brighton, of course, claimed their first ever European win on Thursday night against four-time European champions Ajax. It was a 2-0 win in the Europa League. Slight asterisk is that this Ajax is quite different to those Ajaxes. They were defeated, in fact, having been 2-1 up against Eredivisie leaders PSV this weekend. They then contrived to lose 5-2 and are now bottom of the division after five straight defeats. Good Lord. Villa, their impressive form continued. Another three goals today, Tim.
Yeah, and I think there's an obvious contrast to make between them and Brighton in terms of how they're handling the extra games and the extra physical nature that comes with European football. De Zerbi's spoken about Brighton not being able to handle that very well so far. And of course it is, you know, it's a massive change. You know, if they do well in the competition, you can easily look at sort of upward of 12 to 14 games if you go far on top of what you're already doing. So, but obviously Unai Emery's the master of combining the two. He's done it so many times in his career. I think I'd probably be right in saying that Villa have got more players with European experience than Brighton, but Villa have just got such an established way of playing at the moment. And it's 12 wins in a row at home, making it a real fortress there. Mm. And sort of having the time of their lives, I think. The Villa fans are absolutely loving it.
Thursday night, they were away at AZ Alkmaar, who, of course, were semi-finalists in the Conference League last season. They beat them 4-1.
But that's it. They're not just squeaking past teams 1-0 here and just getting through it on momentum. You know, there's 2-4-1 wins in a row with that West Ham game last week.
Right, yeah.
And now comfortably dispatching of Luton today. It seemed very one-sided.
Right. Liverpool, meanwhile, 3-0 winners today over Nottingham Forest. Luis Diaz not in the squad after the terrible news from Colombia of the kidnapping of his parents, scoring open by Diogo Jota, who promptly held up Luis Diaz's shirt in a gesture of support. But, thoughts with him and his family there. Darwin Nunez doubled the lead before half-time. Before, Daniel, a moment to forget from the Forest keeper.
Yeah, Matt Turner's been okay this season. Forest signed Benfica's number one over the summer, who happens also to be Greek, which doesn't do you any disservice at Forest. And I suspect that next week at home to Villa, he might get his debut because, Matt Turner had a hugely rash moment where he sort of runs out and then sees that ball's about to bounce and then delays slightly, panicking, which only makes it worse, and the ball bounces over his head. And I'm glad he didn't handball it, which would have been the very natural thing to do. But yeah, a horrendous mistake. The game was already done by then. Liverpool were very dominant.
Mo Salah puts away the third. Oh, Adrian.
Yeah, look, it's just another day where the Liverpool forwards and attacking midfielders were very, very impressive. I think they're, without making that much noise, the likes of Szoboszlai and Salah and Jota and Nunez are all chipping away at the goal counts on a consistent basis. You know, they keep on scoring goals. And Nunez had five shots inside the box. You know, he offers great penetration. Defenders are really frightened of him. They tend to back off. And Szoboszlai, just such a classy player. What a clean striker of the ball he is. He created four chances. The two assists that he made were brilliant. Lovely little run beyond Salah to get to the byline and sort of play it across the face of goal. And then the other one, it was his long ball that forced that error from Matt Turner. So yeah, Liverpool are looking good. And the home form, as it always is just so strong. It's a year now since they were last defeated at Anfield in the Premier League. So yeah, very, very impressive.
Extraordinary. 3 points off the top of the table. Meanwhile, the early game on Sunday saw Everton taking a big win at the London Stadium against West Ham. And as mentioned, Daniel, you were there. Mighty 3 points this for the Toffees, which could prove very handy, eh, Daniel?
Yeah, and completely deserved. The first half was wretched, although you understandably got the sense that Sean Dyche was far happier with that situation than David Moyes. And you're talking to West Ham fans at half-time, they're sort of, we need to change it, it needs to improve. And they got worse and Everton got better. The basic difference in the game was Dominic Calvert-Lewin versus Mikel Antonio, because Antonio is, it's a travesty that he is still West Ham's first choice centre-forward. They've got to do something else, whether it's playing Jared Bowen in the middle and bringing in a you know, bringing in Kudus to go with Suchek and James Ward-Prowse and Alvarez. I don't know, but that something's got to change because he just doesn't hold the ball up anymore. He got the ball stuck under his feet for a chance in the first half. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin, I think, had one shot and scored it. Turned in the box really nicely. Great finish. Won three or four, you know, flick-on headers for a teammate. Everton were really good after they went ahead. I worried that they might sit back, which Newcastle did a bit against West Ham when I was last there and ended up conceding the lead twice. They didn't do that. Everton kept on pushing on. Pitford made a couple of brilliant saves. And it's obviously been a tragic week for Everton and a difficult week with the kind of rumours over 12-point deductions, etc. But the away end at full-time kind of showed you everything they need to know. They are bang up for it. And if they keep Dominic Calvert-Lewin fit, he will score 10 goals this season. Dwight McNeil was their top scorer last season. He's right. The difference between them being lower mid-table and being threatened by relegation.
So they've won four of their last six in all competitions. What's been the difference for Everton? Is it just the return of Dominic Calvert-Lewin?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they bought three attacking players on permanent deals in the summer. Beto, Chimiti and Dan Juma, and all of them were on the bench against West Ham. It's Calvert-Lewin. Jack Harrison's coming to the team and looks good. McNeil is good. That midfield looks stronger. They dropped Idrissa Gueye, but it still looks really strong. And they're defending properly. Jarrod Branthwaite's come in and is probably one of the kind of unheralded stars of this Premier League season to date because he's been fantastic, really solid next to Tarkowski. Michael Keane's not in the team anymore, which his detractors would say is a good thing. Yeah, they look really strong. It looks more like a Dyson team with Calvert-Lewin up front to plan to play that Burnley Chris Wood role with the wingers either side of him. And he looks like he's got a team he really fancies at the moment.
Mm. West Ham, by contrast, three straight defeats now, beaten by Villa last weekend, defeated at Olympiacos. That's their first defeat in 18 European games, West Ham. That was on Thursday. And then this here, Wednesday night, they will be hosting Arsenal in the Carabao Cup. That and the Man United Newcastle game, the two televised fixtures from the last 16 of the League Cup, although you can also go along to see Everton, Burnley, Ipswich, Fulham and a bunch of other games. Arsenal, we'll come to them very, very shortly. Big win for them this weekend as we discuss the other things that happen on Saturday and Friday.
Football is bigger and more complicated than ever before. Just ask VAR.
Check complete. It's fine. Perfect. Yeah.
So the Daily Football Briefing is here to help, whether it's the World Cup.
It's a kind of face-saving. Everyone's happy. No one's a loser.
Lionel Messi.
As they say, he completed football.
Or Manchester United.
I mean, the performances all season have been questionable.
That are making you quizzical. The Daily Football Briefing has all the answers you need for every football story that matters, and it does exactly what the name suggests. It's daily, it's brief, and it's all about football. The Daily Football Briefing from The Athletic, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Well, now he's out of his goal. And Neil Mopay, who hasn't scored in ages, is surely going to end his barren run now. He's passed it on instead to Abermo, and he's wrapped the game up. And Brentford have won here again.
Yep, £1 billion later. That's the entertaining sight of Chelsea keeper Robert Sanchez tearing back after two Brentford players who were bearing down on his unattended goal on Saturday. Neil Mopay was one. Gone 13 months without a goal. Still going 13 months without a goal.
Why did he pass? Why did he pass there, James?
He's completely run out of gas, isn't he?
don't know.
It looked like me at five a side, so I'm a big fan of it.
That was an absolute gimme to get that run off your back. I mean, yeah, you might regret that.
What about that moment? There was a snapshot of a pretty extraordinary Brentford performance, especially in that second half away at Chelsea.
Yeah, they're a team of character. They know they're very, very confident without the ball. And I think that's a good trait to have when you face Chelsea, because they will try and hog possession. So you've got to back yourself to stay solid. And they did. And they're just set up, aren't they, to hurt teams on the counter-attack. I think Mbeumo is having a fantastic season. Really has stepped up to the plate in the absence of Ivan Toney. And yeah, they deserved this win. I got to say, when I saw Chelsea's lineup, the starting 11 before the game, I thought, ooh, I don't know about that. I just wasn't sure. I think there's a few players in there
who
wouldn't have got anywhere near Chelsea starting 11s in years gone by, in my opinion.
Like who?
I think De Sassi. I'm not a fan of him at all. I don't rate Sanchez. I think Madueke is a player of promise, but not yet the finished article. Nicholas Jackson, I mean, he was dissected and destroyed by Alan Shearer on Match of the Day, which was fair. It was fair game because the analysis was spot on of what he's not offering Chelsea at the moment. So yeah, look, what I found with Arsenal in the previous week when they played at Chelsea, if you let them come on to you too much, they can swarm you and create things. But if you can step up and engage and just meet them a little bit higher up the pitch and win the ball in midfield, then you can ask questions of their back four. And I just don't think their back four is very good, Chelsea's. They protect it well because they have so much of the ball. So I think the key to success against them is sort of in the middle of the pitch, really being aggressive, win the ball there, and then get at them, and that's what Brentford did in the second half, and they picked them off.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all on Nicholas Jackson, because he's a raw centre forward in his first season in a league, and he's not what Chelsea needed. But the last four Premier League games he started, Chelsea have had 62 shots and haven't scored a goal. So, as I say, he hasn't had all of those or even half of those, but there is a problem about their worry about his finishing, that they try and service him, he misses a couple of chances, and then they start shooting from range because they're worried about overplaying it and giving him a chance that he then misses.
Right.
And it kind of doubles down on that same problem.
Chelsea supporters would point out that they're missing the man who's supposed to be their big goal threat, Christopher Nkunku, but then Brentford are as well, because Ivan Toney is out of the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Levi Colwell, in the heat of the moment, of course, straight after the match, but he said it was luck that wasn't on Chelsea's side, and that if they played Brentford again tomorrow, that they'd beat them. Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Well, that's now three visits in a row that Brentford have won.
Absolutely, and you could see it coming a mile off when Chelsea missed a few early chances. And they did have the opportunities to win this game very easily. So they've only got themselves to blame.
Yeah, Cole Palmer in the first half was pinging those balls over the top.
That's it. You had Madueke hit the bar. Kukurea should have scored or at least passed from 6 yards when he was through on goal. Sterling skied one over. So, yeah, I don't think there was any luck at all, really. It's just pure incompetence.
Well, does this represent any turning point for Brentford after a difficult run? They had the victory last weekend, but it was 8 games without a win before that. Or do they have to wait till the next time they come back to Stamford Bridge?
Well, we've seen before under Thomas Frank that he can set up a team with a game plan. You know, they've done it against Man City. They've done it against very good teams. And obviously something they've been working on all week. So I'm not sure about a corner turn. But, yeah, it was an excellent game plan. I'd also point towards the makers of popular video game FIFA, or whatever it's called. What's it called now, James?
I think it's called FIFA.
It's called FC24 now.
Oh, is it changed?
FC24.
Yeah, this season it's FC24.
Oh, FC.
FC24.
Is it no longer an officially affiliated right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yes. So I looked up the... Having seen Robert Sanchez, despite Maudpay having a 15-yard head start on him,
right,
managed to basically catch him, I thought I'd just look up the sprinting stats. So they've got Robert Sanchez's sprint speed down as 44 out of 100, and Neil Maupay 63 out of 100.
No.
So yeah, I'd be flipping those over, I think.
Speaking of runs, Chelsea have got an absolutely horrible one coming up of Premier League fixtures. After Blackburn in the League Cup on Wednesday, They've got Spurs away, then Man City at home, then Newcastle away, then Brighton at home, then Man United away, although possibly those last two not as difficult, but still, woof. The potential for disaster for a side already in the bottom half again is pretty bad. And is there any question about, you know, financially? I know that Chelsea played pretty fast and loose with what a lot of people think should be their financial parameters. But how important is getting into the top four for their for balancing all their outlay?
Well, it has to be at some point. You cannot continue to spend money and money and money and money and money without that being a problem, particularly at the level that Chelsea have. We know that they've been very, they would consider savvy at extending this money over 6 to 8 years. We'll find out in 6 years when they're still playing Mikhailo Mudryk whether that was a good idea. But yes, they have to be. They have to have at least have a fallow year in the transfer window at some point. And I was speaking to a Chelsea fan last weekend, and he was saying, say it kind of really quietly, but maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. You know, that the season he most enjoyed recently was that Lampard season when they weren't able to register players and they had to deal with what they had. And actually it forced some thinking, it forced some assessment of players, it forced them to work out a hierarchy of you know, what's going to work now, who is going to work in 2 years, who will we not need in 2 years. They don't have to do that at the moment because all they do is just buy another crop of players every transfer window. Mm-hmm. So it might not be the worst thing. But yeah, they might also have just finished 14th in the Premier League before it, which is a bit different.
Yikes, yeah. 11 points they are off the top four. Fully 12 points behind their friends Arsenal, who Saturday afternoon beat Sheffield United 5-0. Three of the goals from Eddie Nketiah. Adrian, you were there. He could have had four.
He could. He turned down the opportunity to take the penalty, which was a nice gesture because... I just think it's thinking of the team as a whole, a little bit like Arsenal did with Kai Havertz' penalty at Bournemouth. Then they thought, well, let's give it to Fabio Vieira. He won it. He hasn't scored this season. Let's get him off the mark. And I thought it was quite a nice gesture. His first goal was brilliant with the touch. It was quite funny. They did actually pick up on it at Match of the Day. I saw it at the time. Austin Trusty shoved Eddie Nketiah off him in the build-up, and that inadvertently gave Eddie the space to get away from him.
Harry Maguire brilliant. Did the same thing to Erling Haaland today, although not quite as visibly. But why would you do that as a defender?
I don't know. I think it's just a little bit of a tussle. It's just sort of get off sort of thing. I think it's just trying to win that physical duel and try and bully the player. But yeah, backfired for Trusty. It was a great touch from Eddie, and then obviously goal number three was a beauty. His first ever for Arsenal in the Premier League from outside the box. I mean, he is famously the six-yard box merchant, isn't he, Eddie Nketiah? So his average distance for goals has shot through the roof with that particular one. But yeah, I was pleased with the performance. It was very controlled. I think what will please Arteta the most is that they gave Sheffield United zilch. Just nothing. Their XG was 0.03. And I'll tell you their shots. They had one shot early on that was blocked from about a yard, as in the defender was a yard away from the player. So you didn't even remember it. And the only other shot was Gustavo Hamer from the halfway line, which almost went out for a throw-in. That was it. I think from Arsenal's point of view, they kept the blades at arm's length very, very nicely. So yeah, it was just what the doctor ordered.
There's been quite a lot of sympathy for... rightly so for Paul Heckingbottom, by the way that Sheffield United kind of reacted late or didn't react at all in this summer transfer window and sold, you know, arguably started with a weaker squad. But that defence is still underperforming. We've played 10 games now, which is a decent sample size. They're on course to allow 300 shots on target this season. Bournemouth were the worst defenders last season with 198. So, I mean, this is like, it's off the chart in terms of how poor defensively they've been. I know they had the horror injury to Chris Basham. I know that they've had problems with personnel and bringing in Austin Trusty into the team, but it's desperate. There's no protection for that defence, and the defence isn't doing anything under pressure. They're just crumpling every week. And 300 shots on target is criminal. And that is still under performance, even if you've had problems over the summer. Paul Heckingbottom will have said at the start of the season, we need to be hard to break down first. We need to be like Luton have been. Luton have lost four games by a single goal. They've drawn two games. Sheffield United are a world away from that, and they finished above Luton last season.
Well, they're officially off to the worst start in Premier League history, 1 point from the 10 matches so far, and a goal difference of minus 22. And to make matters worse, the only other team in the Football League yet to win this season was their neighbours, Sheffield Wednesday. But Sunday, they went and won. Sheffield United are 3 points adrift of 19th place Burnley, who on Saturday became the first team this season to lose to Bournemouth in the league. A first win for Andoni Iraola, and oh, by the looks of it, quite a vital one with your man Bill Foley, the American owner, perched ominously like a kind of
It's Overlord vibes, weren't they? As he was stood there in the director's box.
Because they were trailing Bournemouth, and the glare was, you know, visible from space. Probably Charlie Taylor it was who'd scored for Burnley on his first goal in his 198th appearance for the club. Who got the equaliser for Bournemouth?
Semenyo, was it?
Semenyo, and then that magnificent Harry Kane-esque Philip Billing. A strike and T-shirt reveal.
Yeah, I'm sure that Iraola is pleased that his overlord was impressed enough and that they got 3 points. But it said more about Burnley for me. They're in such a mess. They were basically really good last season at winning the ball high up the pitch with their press. Loads of high turnovers, best in the Championship, think best in the EFL, and created loads of chances from it. And they're trying to do exactly the same thing with new players who don't really know the system. And Premier League teams are really very good at passing around a kind of half press. The number of times, just in this game alone, even on the highlights, that Burnley had four or five players ahead of the ball when Bournemouth had possession. You can't do that as a promoted club. You can't assume you're going to be all right to do that. And I don't think that Vincent Kompany will compromise. And if he doesn't, then either those players are going to have to learn it really, really quickly or they'll go down.
Vincent Kompany pointing to the performance of VAR, which took, I think, over 5 minutes to determine whether Jay Rodriguez had equalised for the Clarets late on, and then failed to spot what looked like a fairly evident defensive handball that might have led to a penalty, or failed to even go back and check on that. Next up for Burnley, intriguingly enough, is a reunion with their former boss, Sean Dyche, as Everton hosts them in the League Cup on Wednesday. Also on Wednesday night, Bournemouth are hosting Liverpool, which could get tasty. All right, next up, we'll hear more about Daniel's trip to the Faroes and touch on Spurs and Wolves. Yes, Tim.
Hello there, Io here. Listen to me on the Athletic Football Podcast, where we go deep on the biggest stories in the game, providing insights and analysis from the very best journalists in the business. You won't get this anywhere else. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual places. Just search the Athletic Football Podcast now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Sports Podcast Awards Soccer Podcast of the Year.
Daft little ground, silly game, f*** off.
An earlier take on the Faroe Islands from broadcasting legend Richard Keys. Daniel, you went along all the same this week.
No better country in Europe for dark forces to start swirling than the Faroes.
Yeah, no, I mean, your pictures looked amazing. Follow Daniel on Instagram to enjoy them yourselves. And we touched on the incredible victory over Olimpia Ljubljana 3-0 in the Conference League on Thursday night. Best bits of this trip for you?
So the Faroes, this sounds very, very twee, but there's a kind of running joke in the Faroes that most tourists ask for directions to the view in holiday destinations. And in Faroes, all you have to do is turn around on the spot. And it is literally like that. Everywhere is either looking at the sea, looking at a mountain, or stood on top or in one or the other. It's just a remarkable place.
Or looking at a football pitch, which is...
Yes, or looking at a football pitch. I mean, I've done this piece, and for the November international break, I'll do a long read about Faroese football in general, because it's an incredible place. They have sunk in the world rankings to about 120, but they have been as high as 75. And this is a country with 50,000 people who... by FIFA ranking points, are basically the most overachieving football nation in the world.
Well, in your article, you break it down even further. Males aged between 15 and 35, they've only got 7,000, but they all play football all the time.
Yeah, they do, because they have four domestic leagues, four domestic divisions.
Wow. Nice that the Faroes have a pyramid.
Lovely. And every ground is at the middle of the town, and all the houses are looking up from the sides of the valley, and everyone's just looking down, literally growing up watching the football club. Every football pitch in the Faroes and the national stadium down is open for kids to play on all the time when there's not a game on. They put the floodlights on at night for the kids to play all the time. And yeah, the whole culture is come and play football in your spare time. We want kids to play football. We want it to be a participation sport. It's not just football, although that's what I'm going to write about. Handball and volleyball, they just overachieve at everything. It can only be the population that holds them back, because 50,000 people just isn't enough to create an elite team. But everyone I spoke to, the next thing that they want is for one of their players to get the kind of big move, as happened with Iceland, with a kind of six times as big a population. That's what they want. The difference between them and Iceland is that Iceland have these indoor domes where you can play in the winter. The Faroes don't. And it was cold enough in October, never mind November onwards. And so that it's a summer league, which has its drawbacks. But the football culture is joyous. It really is. It's like a kind of Sunday league mixed with tropical island. It's so good. Every little village has this football team, and everyone grows up and everyone plays for the team, and you end up playing second tier league football of your country because you are born there at about the right time.
Brilliant. Can Kui, is that right? Kui?
Kui, yeah.
Kui Klaksvik. Can they become the first Faroese team to qualify from a European group stage?
That's their thing now. They're like, well, yeah, well, next we have to qualify. And look, they can win away in Ljubljana. I don't think they will, but they definitely can. They've still got to play Slovan Bratislava at home. They only lost 1-0 away there, and they were annoyed with how they played. They will lose away at Lille, because Lille will have been smarted by that result and will probably need to win it to qualify. My suspicion is they'll finish third in the group, but they will give it a go next season. The only kind of downside, and Kaoi admit this themselves, the only downside is that the money they're making, I think they've made about €4.5 million from the Conference League. I mean, that dwarfs every other club in every other league in the Faroes combined. So that is a slight drawback. They're now going to win the league in every season, I'm sure. But yes, they will be aiming for Europe again.
Magnificent. All right. Of course, Tuesday we'll see the Totally Football Show's European edition, a return in which there's loads to talk about. Big weekend, of course, for English players abroad. Jude Bellingham with a brace to turn El Clasico around as Real Madrid came from behind to win that. Harry Kane with that extraordinary hat-trick as Bayern beat Darmstadt 8-0. But also really, really worrying stories once again from Ligue 1. Marseille were due to be playing Lyon on Sunday night. As we record, very unlikely that game's going to go ahead. After Fabio Grosso received a serious injury to the face, Marseille supporters attacking the Lyon bus with rocks, and a nasty injury for the Lyon manager Fabio Grosso. But more on that, of course, in Tuesday's Totally Football Show European edition. Quick shout as well for Monday, Full Time Europe, which is the Athletic Women's Football Podcast too. They'll be talking about Nations League action there. Meantime, back to the Premier League for us, and league-leading Spurs roll on. The dynamic Tottenham Hotspur heading to Selhurst Park on Friday night, as did our very own Tim Spears who was really, really bored in the first half, Tim.
Yeah, it was awful. It was a dreadful first half. The only thing I remember, actually, even 48 hours later, is Pape Sarr falling over as he tried to cross the ball. Mm. But that's the only thing I'll remember from it. It was dreadful. But
second half, any better?
It sort of had all the makings of Spurs kind of coming unstuck. I thought Palace and Roy Hodgson were doing a proper number on them. They completely shut down Yves Bissouma, who was man-marked by Will Hughes, and just stopped Spurs playing through midfield, which has been such a strength for them this season. And they resorted to sort of Maddison, not long balls over the top, but direct balls into the box, which Mark Gay was just sweeping up. So, yeah, and Spurs didn't get much better in the second half, to be honest, but they got lucky. They got an ugly goal, and they ended up winning 2-1, despite having had one shot on target.
Right.
So
Joel Ward, it was, who diverted James Maddison's cross into his own net, and then Son Heung-min doubling the lead later on with their only shot on target. James Maddison, the signing of the season in the Premier League?
I think so. I think he's the form player in the Premier League at the moment, and every single week. It's not just the goals and assists, which are magnificent, but everything goes through him. You know, he's their conductor and their... from all parts of midfield, it's not just that he's sort of stood in the 10 position and then playing nice through balls. You know, he comes deep to get it off the centre halves as well. He sort of plays three midfield roles in one. And then he's got the end product at the end of it. So Spurs, it was good to see them win in a different way, because they have been sort of blowing teams away with this fast, creative, very nice football. But this was ugly. And, you know, typical difficult place to go on a Friday night, but they came through it. And some of the numbers that they're racking up now are very impressive. So in a 20-team Premier League season, no one's ever won as many as they have at this stage and not reached the top four. And you'd think with five places for Champions League, you know, they're looking pretty good for that. It's the best ever start to a Premier League managerial career from Ange Postecoglou in terms of the points that he's got. Son has scored 8 in 10 as opposed to 10 in 36 last season. And they briefly went 5 clear for the first time since 1961.
Good Lord.
Which is when they last won the league. So that shows you how rare this is for them. And I think there is room for improvement. There are a couple of players that just... I mean, Richarlison looks like the odd man out to me. It's
Rodrigo Bentancur making his return.
So Bentancur came back. I mean, he was, apart from Harry Kane, he was their best player last season. He was, he's been out for 8 months, but he'll add some real class and guile to that midfield. And I think... If you look at the fact they're scoring a lot of goals, but two of their front three just aren't scoring. So Richarlison, Richarlison can't shoot at the moment, and Kulusevski just won't shoot. It's this infuriating thing that he just gets in great positions and then just dithers in possession. And you look at someone like Brennan Johnson coming on and starting to make an impact, which was their big summer signing, who hasn't really contributed yet. You look at Bentancur coming back. It's interesting. I think the biggest thing for Spurs in the next few weeks will be their mentality, because they're the front runners now, which is something that they won't be used to.
Okay. The biggest thing, perhaps, in the slightly more long-term future is January, which brings not only the Africa Cup of Nations, don't know how much that's going to affect them, but an Asian Cup, which runs from, I think, kind of earliest January to for about a month, kind of the 11th of February, I think it wraps up, which will take Sun out of the picture, you'd imagine, for a fair chunk, if not all of that.
And then two of their midfield three so far, Bissouma and Sarr,
will
also be going. So, you know, Højbjerg came in against Fulham the other night and did a good job, but he's no Bissouma.
So how much cover do they have in the squad for that? Or is that where this title bid that the Spurs fans are beginning to believe in is going to come unstuck?
They'll have to find replacements, because, like as I've said, no one else is really scoring consistently apart from Son. But is Daniel Levy the kind of guy to go out and throw a load of money at, you know, squad players to get them through a few weeks? But how often are Spurs in this position? I mean, even in the Leicester title winning season, when Spurs were the ones that were pushing them, Spurs never even topped the table that year. Mm. You know, this is so rare for them to be in this position. And the mentality will be important, because it's still this sort of honeymoon phase. Nothing to lose. It's all very fun and it's new. But there will come a point, if it hasn't started to happen already, where there is something to lose. And if they're still top in a few weeks, and they've got some very difficult fixtures in the next few weeks, by the way, but if they get through those, still top of the table, then you really start to get into something to lose territory, which of course is something Arsenal went through last season.
Indeed so. Any other thoughts on Spurs before we deal with the last fixture from this weekend, which was Wolves Newcastle?
It's just Maddison for me. He just looks the most confident player in the division. It's remarkable, really, that Tottenham had such an easy run at getting him. Yeah, I think is he a Manchester United fan? I'm sure I read that previously. You just think of United choosing Mount over Madison, and it's sort of laugh out loud, really, isn't it? In terms of that choice, he's been sensational, and it's lovely for Son, isn't it, to have a different partner. He loves to have a brother within that team. He lost Harry, and now he's got Madison. So, yeah, for as long as those two stay fit and healthy, Spurs are going to create a lot of chances. I looked ahead of this weekend, and Spurs, for me, well, not just for me, but Spurs, full stop, have been uncreative, I think it's fair to say, over the last few years. Ahead of this weekend, three of the top six chance creators in the Premier League play for Spurs. So, you know, that's the difference under Postecoglou.
Madison's kind of the perfect storm of this Ange Postecoglou good vibes honeymoon as well, because I was just hearing Tim talk about him kind of dropping deep and drifting wide and being positionless, and that being a really good thing for Spurs. I watched a lot of Leicester at the end of last season, and fans were really on his back because he was dropping too deep, he was drifting too far wide, he wasn't staying high enough the pitch, it's so funny how that can just change in an instant by who you've got around you, by the mood, via a million and one different things. And signing players from relegated clubs can be a risk. It doesn't always work out. There can be, particularly when they're such a key creator or a key cog in that team, to be able to replicate that and not to diminish any of Son's responsibility, in fact, to enlarge it. I know losing Harry Kane helps a huge amount in that, but that's a really hard thing for Postecoglou to have juggled. And he's done it seamlessly. He's made Madison look like he's been there 3 years, which is really, really hard to do when you're a new manager yourself.
Remarkable. All right. Tim, also this weekend, Wolves 2, Newcastle 2. Where do you want to start on this one?
It was a good game. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I felt like Wolves sort of went toe-to-toe with Newcastle, and they're sort of going back to this sort of fast and fun thing they had under Nuno a few years ago, which is nice. And they're doing all right. They're on an unbeaten run of five games now. And they've played Man City, Villa and Newcastle in that run.
Yeah. It's pretty good. Came from behind twice here to cancel out Callum Wilson goals. Second of which, I think the consensus is, came from a penalty that should never have been given.
I mean,
or at least give it, but take it back after.
Wolves fans love moaning about refs. Mm. And every single season they've been in the Premier League, they have these sort of rough injustices that they just love moaning about. I mean, they obviously hate it as well. But yeah, that's three this season now. I don't want to keep going on about James, but you know, there was the Onana one on Kalajic on the opening weekend of the season where he assaulted him in the air and it wasn't a penalty. And then there was the one at Luton a few weeks ago where João Gomez, the ball deflected off his foot onto his arm in the air, and that was somehow deemed a penalty. And then this one, I mean, Hwang is trying to clear the ball, basically.
Yeah.
And
he clearly on the replay withdraws his...
That's it. So he takes a big backswing, ready to clear the ball. He sees Fabian Schär coming towards him. So he tries to stop his follow through, and he does stop it. And then there is contact, and it's debatable who initiates that contact.
Oh, is there contact?
I think there is. Okay. I think Schär definitely sort of falls over the foot. I didn't think it was a penalty. Okay. I didn't think it was a foul.
Oh, it wasn't quite as egregious as I may have previously thought. But anyway, fantastic goal from Hwang to bring it back to 2-2. Was that a grunt of admiration from Daniel there?
Yeah. I think it was me. I think we both grunted or made a noise. It's a lovely touch, wasn't it, Daniel? And you know, he sold the defender beautifully.
But yeah, I'm so impressed with Gary O'Neill. Like, you know, we kind of spoke last week about maybe Bournemouth made the wrong decision in sacking him. It was by no means a given, and Tim will know this more than me, it was by no means a given that he was deemed a good appointment by Wolves in the summer. I think it was almost, by the most pessimistic fans, it was seen as maybe the owners almost giving up on the bells and whistles of the Project Portugal, and where's our flashy named European managers gone? We settled for the cheap option, which, you know, maybe they did, but it's certainly working. They are definitely not going down, and they've played their home games,
Daniel,
have been basically against...
God's sake. Tim's a little bit upset with...
Yeah. Don't say that.
Well, sorry. Yeah, OK. Well, I think Forest are going down, you think Wolves. That's fine. But no, they've played five home games this season.
Right.
And they've not played a team below seventh. Brighton are the lowest.
Scored in all of them, haven't they?
And they've scored in all of them. Wait. And their strikers are scoring.
Wait, here's the slight wrinkle on all of this. They've scored 12 goals this season, excluding own goals. All of them were either scored or assisted by Huang or Pedro Neto. And hence the hush that fell over Molineux 5 minutes after Huang made it 2-2 when Pedro Neto was bursting towards the Newcastle goal and suddenly stopped because Twang, his hamstring had gone. How bad is it looking, Tim?
I don't know if you've been watching much of the Cricket World Cup, but it reminded me of when India lose a wicket because the whole place just went completely silent, and then there's like gasp and then a bit of grief and then, you know, silence. This is another big test for Gary O'Neill now because no one has more assists in the Premier League this season. Wolves' style suits Neto so well. No one's had more fast breaks in the Premier League this season. It's very direct and quick on the break. It's all about running and carrying the ball. And no one's doing better than that in the league right now than Pedro Neto. So hopefully he'll be okay. Yeah, he was walking when he left the stadium. He'd been carried off the pitch. But that's a good
that's
start.
That's quite a low bar though, isn't it?
Can, straws here.
Can I ask you something, Tim? With Neto, I did a piece on him this week as well. I mean, phenomenal assists. The goals that he's created from dribbles. It's either a wonder dribble or just an unbelievable delivery of his left foot that he produces to create all of these assists. There's a lot of noise about Pedro Neto and Arsenal have had a long-standing interest. Do you think that Wolves would entertain bids in January for Pedro Neto? Because I can envisage clubs wanting him because he is exhilarating. He is rapid. He's statistically the second fastest player in the Premier League this season. Do you think they could resist it or not?
I mean, up until last summer, the Wolves had done pretty well at keeping hold of their best players and only selling them when they wanted to. You know, they kept Jimenez when he was in his great run of form. They kept Traore when everyone wanted him. You know, they sold Jota when they wanted to Liverpool. But the difference with Wolves now is they had this huge financial issue in the summer where they had to ship about £100 million worth of players. And they did spend a bit too. From what I'm told, they're not completely out of the woods yet on that front. So if Arsenal or another big club came calling in January with a huge bid, I think they would have to look at it pretty closely. He's clearly a player that's destined to end up at a Champions League club, and Wolves' financial position perhaps means that would be sooner rather than later. But obviously we'll see what the injury news is first.
All right. Newcastle with the 2-2 here, picking up a point after their disappointment midweek against Borussia Dortmund. Some tough games coming up for the Magpies in their shiny green outfit. Next 10 fixtures in all competitions will see them play Man United twice, Arsenal, Spurs, Chelsea, Dortmund, Paris Saint-Germain and Milan. All of which, of course, without Sandro Tonali, as all their games will be for the next 10 months after he received a suspension for that period for breaching betting rules.
I can't help think that this is slightly knee-jerk because they have just only lost to Dortmund and drawn at Wolves, but I can't help thinking that if Newcastle could have their time back in the summer again, they might do things slightly differently. I don't mean Tonali because that's very obviously. But they signed three players for either big fees or committed a big fee in the case of Lewis Hall. And that was Lewis Hall, a left back. That was Harvey Barnes, a left winger. And that was Tino Livramento, who is a right back. And I'd argue that possibly Newcastle's three best players this season have been Anthony Gordon, the left winger, Kieran Trippier, the right back, and Dan Burn's been really consistent at left back. And what you've got is these three players who, I know Barnes is injured now, but he wasn't starting anyway. I think he started two league games. The others have played about 50 minutes between them. And what they are missing is centre-backs, because Botman's injured. Isaac's now injured as a striker, and Callum Wilson is, sadly, if you play him twice a week, he will eventually pick up a muscle injury. And just, it was almost like they were building for the future and just took their eye off the needs of the now. And that might cost them with this kind of rolling Champions League, Premier League commitment.
Yeah, note of concern there from Daniel's story. Adrian, where will all your stuff that you mentioned be popping up?
Different bits, yeah. The Premier League website. But we've got the EFL podcast, What the EFL?
Of course.
That'll be out on Monday afternoon, reacting to the weekend and some sackings. Nigel Pearson. Yeah. Old Ostrich, he's departed Bristol City earlier today. Joey Barton's gone from Bristol Rovers and Gareth Ainsworth.
Yeah,
Gareth Ainsworth has left QPR. So lots to get stuck into.
And you'll also be featuring on the Handbreak Off Athletic podcast about, Arsenal.
Yep, yep. Yeah, absolutely. I've got a live show coming up. I mean, it's a sellout, so I can't plug any tickets, but really looking forward to that. I think that's in
But make sure
weeks.
You mention it. Nice, yep, gotcha. Lovely stuff, Adrian. Thank you for being with us today. Daniel, many thanks to you after all your travels. Fascinating stuff. Tim, thank you. And many thanks to Seb as well for pitching in, even though he didn't need to, just because he happened to be walking by. So nice. Producer Charlie put it all together. Listener, you did the hard bit. As ever, we're back on Tuesday with our Euro show. Do join us for that. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.